have been in the middle of a series, and we've taken 2 weeks off just because the last one was so exciting, and we are covering how to overcome these spiritual problems that we have in our lives. 3 weeks ago, we were on overcoming spiritual blindness. This week, spiritual selfishness. We use this word sacrifice from time to time. We all sacrifice things. Jenny and I gave up Dish TV, except it's DirecTV. I know it. DirecTV, we gave that up because we needed to pay down debt. We went so far as, and this is heresy in the Heck household, we canceled a Disney vacation in order to pay down debt because we needed to. There was something that we desired, which was paying down debt and getting financially on a solid footing. So we gave up something else that we wanted in order to achieve that. And you've all done that. We give up things that are desirable. We sacrifice things in order to achieve or get something else. Whenever I think of the word sacrifice, and I'm just thinking about my own personal life, I think of my wife. And I think about how much she has given up to make our family operate. She was gone this last week for 5 days. I wore the same shirt 3 days in a row. Ask them if you don't believe me. But she was gone 5 days this last week, and I realized how much the system that we have worked out at home falls apart when she's not around. It really does. Our system is she does everything. And then when she's not there, it just doesn't operate nearly as well. But I do, I think about the things that she has sacrificed to make our family go. Money. Jenny spends too much money. I know that. You know that. The American people know that. But what is she spending the money on? She's spending it on me. She's spending it on our kids. I don't know the last time I ever remember her doing a shopping spree for herself. She gave up clothes that she liked and personal luxuries. She gave up her sports car to drive a minivan. I mean, that's taking it on the chin. And then her job. She worked for the city of Kokomo doing communications. She gave that up to stay home and raise our children. To me, that's sacrifice. And obviously, sanity, that goes without saying when you're raising children, that you give up these things. So when I look at it, I say, this is a woman who understands sacrifice. Or does she? Do any of us really understand what sacrifice is? Biblically speaking, I don't know that we do. 3 weeks ago, we were talking about Peter's confession that his spiritual blindness was healed when Jesus looks at him and says, I know what everybody else is saying about me. Who do you say that I am? And at that moment, Peter says, you are the Messiah. You are the one that we have been waiting for. You are the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And yet, even after his spiritual blindness was healed, what do we see? Right after that, Jesus starts telling them, all right, so listen, guys, I've got to die. I'm going to be tortured to death, and then I'm going to be resurrected. And what did Peter do? Peter jumped in and said, no, that's not going to happen. You're not going to die because the Messiah can't die. He's correcting the guy that he just said was the long-awaited Messiah. In other words, the cross got in his way. Even though his spiritual blindness had been healed, he knew Jesus was the Messiah. He wanted the Messiah on his terms. I don't think Peter's alone. I think a lot of us want to call ourselves Christians, but we want Jesus on our terms. We want a Jesus that affirms our political opinions. We want a Jesus that affirms what we're doing with our money. We want a Jesus that affirms how we are handling our relationships. We want the Messiah, but we want him on our terms. And that's not the way it works. When I got the job here, like the official job here, my dad gave me the book by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian. It's called The Cost of Discipleship. I started reading this, and I thought, I'll just get back and forth and go back and forth because I got other things going on. I mean, that's one of those books that, Matt's looking at YouTube videos on my lunch. I'm studying theologians. I don't know what his problem is. But anyway, in that book, Bonhoeffer writes these words. He says, when Christ calls a man, he bids him, he tells him, come and die. That's Jesus' invitation to all of us. Not come here and I'll boost your confidence. Come here and I'll walk with you from time to time and I'll be there to pick you up when you fall. No. He's saying, if you want to come to me, you need to die. That is the ultimate sacrifice. Now, let's pick up right where we left off. We're in Mark chapter 8, so if you got your Bibles, you flip to Mark chapter 8. If you're a heathen and didn't bring it, it's fine. I'll put it on the screen. But we're in Mark chapter 8, and I want to pick up right where we left off. I'm giving you a second while I hydrate to get there in Mark chapter 8. Go. And good. All right, this is Jesus. He called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. Now listen, this is one of those terms. Christ's command to deny yourself is one that I don't know that we actually get. It's not like I'm not denying myself in the way Jesus is talking about when I give up a vacation to pay down debt. That isn't denying myself. When Jenny gives up her job at the city to come home and raise our children, we can call that a sacrifice, but that isn't anywhere close to being on par with what Jesus is saying in this passage, to deny yourself. Do you know that this word deny is only used in two contexts in Scripture? You see it used here, and the only other time you see it is when Peter denies Jesus right before his crucifixion. You remember that? Remember when that happened? This is the passage. Meanwhile, Peter's in the courtyard below. One of the servants' girls who worked for the high priest came by and noticed Peter warming himself at the fire. She looked at him closely and said, "You were one of those with Jesus of Nazareth," but Peter denied it. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. And he went out into the entryway. Just then a rooster crowed. When the servant girl saw him standing there, she began telling the others, "This man is definitely one of them." And Peter denied it. "Shut up, little girl." He denies it again. A little later, some of the other bystanders confronted Peter and said, "You must be one of them because you are a Galilean." And look at what Peter does. Peter swears, "A curse on me if I'm lying. I don't know this man you are talking about." And then the rooster crowed, and Peter breaks down and weeps. I mean, that is denial of Jesus. Send me to my grave if I'm lying. I don't know who this is. What does Peter do right there? He looks at people and he emphatically renounces any loyalty, any devotion, even any familiarity with Jesus. Bingo. That's it. When Jesus is using the word deny, that's what he's talking about. When he is telling you to deny yourself, take up your cross and follow him, that's what he is saying. He is saying you need to emphatically renounce your loyalty to your old self, who you used to be. You need to emphatically renounce your devotion to your old mind, the way that you used to think. You need to emphatically renounce your familiarity with your old desires. How many of us do that? Or how many of us come to Christ, we have that great experience, and then we continue living the way that we have always lived, but we just have a little Jesus on our dashboard, and we carry our Bible with us. That isn't denying oneself. That's not what he's talking about. Here's what denying means. It means looking at our old selves and saying, "I know what you want. You want to be served. So instead, we're putting the boots on, and we're going to go serve others." What it is it's recognizing I want to go first, and for that reason, I will choose to go last. It is understanding and acknowledging that my earnest desire, and man, this is tough for me, is to open my mouth and give that person a piece of my mind because they have earned it. And yet, instead, I choose to be silent. That's denying yourself. Renouncing any recognition, any familiarity with who I used to be. Now listen, if you struggle with that, you're not alone. The disciples struggled with that. Just read these couple chapters in Mark and you see it over and over. They demonstrate this broken, crucified life is one that they don't even get. Do we get it? Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians. This is what he says. "Don't you realize that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who lives inside you and was given to you by God? You don't belong to yourself, for God bought you with a high price, so you must honor God with your body." And what do we do with that passage? We start talking about, well, this is why you can't have tattoos. And we start talking about you can't have piercings because of this verse. That's not at all. What a superficial reading of that passage that is. This is talking about how you and who you are doesn't belong to you and who you used to be. It belongs to someone entirely different. I don't have time for a drink. We're still going. I want you to visualize and imagine what would happen if we actually denied ourselves and did this. Like, who would we be and how would we impact our community if we went all in with our faith that it wasn't just words, but it's actually who we were? What would that be like if we actually left behind our godly relationships? Those ungodly relationships that we know are not right, we know do not honor God, but we want them because they fulfill some desire in us, even though Christ is telling us no, we want it. What if we actually left those behind and gave the message to the world, nope, worldly stuff is not for me. I follow Jesus. What if we committed ourselves to avoiding the sexual temptations and other temptations that we play around with all the time? I mean, I see it with teenagers. Teenagers that follow Christ, how closely can I get to the edge of what he said I can't do, and I'm going to just teeter here on the edge, when what should we be doing? Denying ourselves and running in the opposite direction. What would happen if we actually did that, if we denied ourselves? What if we didn't shrink back from scriptural truth when it stands in the way of what pop culture wants? Oh, I know, people say nasty things about us on Facebook, but what if we didn't care? What if we were more concerned about denying ourselves and saying, yeah, I'm a follower of God, and that means I stand on the authority of His word? What would happen if we did that? What if we stopped always trying to get our way? It stopped becoming about us. What if we stopped offering unsolicited advice when people don't ask for it? We don't tell them what they should do and how you would have handled the situation. Nobody cares how you would have handled the situation. Stop offering unsolicited advice. What if we stopped always trying to get people to look at us or to look up at us? What if we stopped worrying about always having to impress people or this? What if we stopped being annoyed when we were overlooked? Man, we hate that in our culture today. I was talking to, I would consider him a spiritual mentor, not Dave, so nobody get on Dave about this. But this guy was telling me that he had spent months and months, if not years, trying to disciple and bring someone to Christ. Worked with them, prayed for them, prayed with them, and finally that individual, after months and years of effort, that individual came forward and accepted Christ. And when he did, he started telling everybody about all the people that he wanted to thank for making such a positive impact on him. And he left that man out. And the guy said, I struggled with that for months. I was bitter about it. I was even angry about it. I invested so much in this guy, and he didn't give me any credit for leading him to Christ. And then God convicted him. It's not about you. This isn't about us. This is about Him. Who cares who gets the glory if a soul has been saved by the blood of Jesus Christ? We rejoice no matter who it is that impacted that person. What if it wasn't about us, but instead it was about Him? Do you see how spiritual selfishness always gets in the way and we want it to be us? What if, this may hurt some of us, what if we started using our resources, what we've been blessed with, to build God's kingdom instead of our own kingdom? I mean, stop and think about that. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, we have this cliched phrase, and we do it all the time in Christian churches, that we're going to go out and change the world. Well, we're going to change the world. Nobody ever talks about how we're going to change the world, just that we're going to change the world. So we have this really moving message and this really moving service, and we sing great songs, and the challenge is to go out and change the world, and everybody's, yeah, we're going to go change the world, and we leave, and nobody knows what to do because there's no plan to it. Nobody, we're just going to change the world. So what if we actually came up with a strategic plan on how to change the world? I did something, and this is not something that we all have to buy into, but this is just a radical thought, okay? What if we took four areas of our world, and we said, this is how the church of Jesus, is going to change our world? Four different areas. I'm going to speed through this pretty quick, all right? I'm going to speed up a little bit, so buckle up because we got to get, oh, quit laughing and stay with me, all right? Spiritually, okay, that's one of the areas. What if we did these things? Notice I'm actually putting numbers on this. This is a strategic plan for changing the world. We did this. We sponsored 150,000 new missionaries. We tripled the amount of money that we're spending in the world on Bible translations. We distributed 20,000 copies of 100 of the best Christian books in four different languages around the world. We built 75,000 new churches in Asia and South America and Africa. We maintained 350 Christian radio stations in the least evangelized parts of the world. We created this massive advocacy organization to combat sex trafficking, the sex trade in the world. The Church of Jesus is going to take a stand in that. What if we hired 1,500 new ministers to disciple foreign students, and we provided 50,000 seminary scholarships to students in Africa, Asia, and South America? That's spiritual. That's a lot of money. That's spiritual. And then, humanitarian-wise, we're going to change the world there. What if the Church of Jesus eliminated polio in the world? We can. We've got the ability. We just don't have the investment to do it, to take it and eliminate it around the world. We directly sponsored over 20 million children worldwide. We provided full resources to treat malaria and wipe it out in the world. We established 10,000 new faith-based programs to deter and to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS. We provided food and clothing and shelter to every single refugee in Africa and Asia. We quadrupled the operating budget of Habitat for Humanity. We doubled the funding to organizations that are giving prosthetics and eye care to the most needy parts of the world. We built 1 million new clean water drilling projects so everyone in the world has potable water. This sounds like pie in the sky, right? Okay, that's just two areas. Then we get to the area of cultural. We're going to hire 11,000 new youth ministers to disciple U.S. teens because they need it. Okay, and then we're going to fund, I'm kidding, we fund a massive Christian think tank to advocate Christian ethics, to explain to our confused world why God's understanding of the way we should live is better than what we come up with. That we refitted the heating and air conditioning units of 20,000 of the most rundown buildings. We launched 300 cross-racial immersion programs so that the Church of Jesus was not divided along racial lines. We raised the salaries of the neediest ministers. I like that one. Kidding. Not really. Fund 6,000 new family counseling organizations. We hire 45,000 new ministers just in nursing care facilities so that the elderly know that they're not forgotten. And we funded 1,000 new prison ministries. Those are three areas. How about number four? How about when it comes to education and economics? We pay off the mortgage of 500 Christian schools. We provide 100 contributions of $2 million to seminaries and colleges and Christian universities. We provide church-based job training, bring in all of these welfare recipients and train them, give them a skill so that they can go out and make a life for themselves. We provide research fellowships to 150 of the best Christian schools, $10,000 scholarships to 15,000 needy Christian students, financial debt management for hundreds of thousands of Christians. We established 25 Christian organizations to give utilities to the elderly and the neediest, and we give 300 grad school scholarships to PhD students. All right, there it is. There's my plan. You do those things, you're going to change the world, right? Do you know how much money that would cost if we actually wanted to do that? I will tell you how much money that will cost. The Docent Research Group found that to do all of these things in those four areas, we talk about changing the world, to do those four things, it would be a combined $46 billion to do that. Do you know what $46 billion is? That is the equivalent of everyone who is a regular church attender in America, not the Christmas Easter attenders, a regular church attender where you are here every week. If you just tithed, we would have that money at our disposal. Are we actually dying to self and seeking to build God's kingdom, or are we instead building our own kingdom? We've got the ability, we just don't have the confidence, we don't have the faith, we don't have the trust. I mean, tithing is the Bible's training wheels. It's where God says, all right, test me. I'll let you keep 90% of what is mine. I don't know that I can do that, God. And so we don't trust him and we don't do it. And then we wonder why our faith is lacking. This is what I'm talking about. Evelyn Underhill, the author, writes it this way about a self-focused life. We spend lives conjugating three verbs: to want, to have, and to do. We crave, we clutch, and we fuss. We crave the things that we want, we clutch the things that we have, and then we fuss about the things that we don't have. That's what we do. And we're kept in perpetual unrest. Do me a favor and test your life against these things. On a daily basis, does this not define you? Does this not define us? That you are constantly in a state of craving and clutching and fussing, and that's what your 24-hour day cycle is about? Those things. Do you think that maybe we'd get some rest from this perpetual unrest if that stuff didn't matter to us anymore? Because it wasn't about us. We actually died to self. You know, I've thought about this. If I was trying to get people to follow me, here's what I would not do. I would not do what Jesus did. I would not stand in front of people and say, hey, you follow me, and if you do, you're going to get the cross. Because these people then knew what the cross meant, right? It meant three things: pain, shame, and humiliation. So if I'm trying to get you to follow me, it's not a big sell to step forward and say, all right, if you will just follow me, here's what you're going to get: pain, shame, and humiliation. Who's in? I mean, nobody's going to want to jump on that if that's your big selling point, right? And so that's why, if you think about it, when Jesus said that's what's required to be one of my followers, you have all of these people who have been around to see the show. I mean, they've been there to see the tricks, the magic tricks. And as soon as Jesus starts talking about dying to self and taking up your cross, that'll do. They're going to pack up the bags and head on out. They don't want anything to do with this. And I wonder if that's us also, because we'd rather crave and clutch and fuss. We don't want the pain, shame, and humiliation that comes from dedicating our lives to the cross. But Jesus offers them, and I think he offers you, something very important to think about before you make that decision. Look at what he says. If you try to hang on to your life, keep craving, clutching, and fussing. If you try to hang on to your life, you'll lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, for the sake of the good news, you will save it. And what do you benefit if you gain the whole world, but you lose your own soul? If is anything worth more than your soul? You know what Jesus is saying here, right? What is the wiser path to take? Here's what you can do. Not deny yourself. Keep accruing things for yourself through 40, 50 more years of your life. And then eventually, you're going to die. And when you die, you're going to lose all that stuff that you built up for yourself. And also, you're going to lose your soul. So there's path number one. Path number two that you have is you deny yourself now, you take up your cross, you endure the shame and the pain and the humiliation of following Christ, and in the end, you gain eternal life. Eternal life. Which one will a wise person choose here? And which one will a self-focused person choose? This is why Jim Elliot wrote it this way. He said, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep. What can you not keep? Your life. If you give up your life now and all the things that you claim to want and you're going to build up, if you give that up now, you're not going to be able to keep it in the end anyway. If you give it up now, you're going to gain what you cannot lose, which is your soul. That isn't dumb. That is the height of wisdom. George MacDonald wrote it this way. If we don't die to ourselves, we can't live to God. And if you don't live to God, you're dead. So how wise of a path is that? And yet so many of us do that. The short-sighted, we choose the here and the now, the feelings that we can have right now, and we take that over the there and the later, the eternal side of things. I mean, that's a bad trade, right? You remember the worst trades in human history? I think of Esau. You remember what Esau traded? Please tell me you remember this. Dude traded his birthright for a bowl of soup. How short-sighted and in the moment must you be to say, yeah, I mean, I like my birthright, but the chicken noodle sounds really good. So here it is. That is one of the worst trades in the history of mankind. And if you think that one's bad, flip a few pages over and you get Judas. What does Judas trade? Yeah, I'll take those 30 pieces of silver and, yeah, you take the Son of God. I mean, that's a really bad trade. When the Colts traded Trent Richards for Trent Richardson, that one was really bad too. I mean, first-round draft picks for a guy that just fumbles and hands it to the other team. That's a bad, okay, I destroyed my credibility here. But listen, these are really bad trades, but none of them are as bad as what we're talking about here, right? I mean, we do this. You and I do this all the time. We trade the eternal riches of life with Christ for what? Sexual pleasure? Really? Your sexual pleasure, your five-second muscle spasm is worth your eternal soul? Are you serious? That's what we do. How dumb is that? Now listen, those thrills that we give it up, that's fun, right? Well, they can be, but not always. I mean, sexual freedom and sexual liberty, that sounds like a lot of fun. But STDs and unplanned pregnancies and heartbreak, all of that can ruin what you think is going to be so much fun. And living selfishly, that sounds fun. But divorce and ruined marriages and awkward family interactions with children, strained relationships, loneliness, all of that is going to ruin selfish living. Listen, I'm not going to lie. For some people, sometimes, living for themselves can be a wild and a fun ride. For what, 30 years? 40 years? Can I tell you the truth? You know this, but I'm just going to drop it on you. And some of you who are younger, you're just going to have to take my word for it. The cold, hard truth is eventually you're going to get too old for those things. You're going to get too worn out. Nobody wants to go to the club and see the 40-year-old guy hanging out in the back with a bunch of 19 and 20-year-olds. You're the creepy old guy. I think of Hugh Hefner, right? The guy who lives for earthly experiences. Did you see that man by the time he got into his 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s? He can't do anything. He's walking around in a bathrobe and a weird sailor hat. He can't experience any of the things that he used to think were so great. Is that worth your eternal soul? Really? Maybe there's a better way. The other way is to die to self, to crucify the flesh, and to live for Christ. And you know what you escape if you do it that way? Look at this. Keep reading in Mark chapter 8, verse 38. If anyone, Jesus says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my message in these adulterous and sinful days, are you? Are you ashamed of him in this sinful generation? What does that mean, by the way? A lot of times when we think of being ashamed of Jesus, we think, oh, that means like we blush when somebody calls us a Christian. Or somebody's calling out Christianity and we're sitting there and we're just silent because we don't want to stick our neck out. I suppose that would be being ashamed of Jesus, but that's not what's being talked about here. You know what being ashamed of Jesus is? Refusing to identify with him and pick up your cross and live the way he's called you to. And why do you do that? Because you're ashamed of the cost of discipleship. You're afraid what people will say about you if you give up earthly pleasures for eternal riches. You're worried about seeking the applause of men. That is being ashamed of Christ. You know what that means? Listen to me, church. It means you can be here every week. And you can sing those songs every week as loud as you can. You can take communion regularly. You can pray like nobody's business. You can know all 66 books of the Bible. And yet, if you refuse to deny yourself and live for Christ instead of your own selfish desires, it's because you are ashamed of what living for him would do to you in this world. You can still fall into this category. And by the way, this verse is pretty alarming because what happens to us if we are ashamed of him? Jesus says, if anyone is, the Son of Man will be ashamed of that person when he returns in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. What does Jesus mean? Listen, we have this pop culture understanding of what happens on Judgment Day, where we're standing before God and Jesus is in the back and you step forward and you haven't lived for him, and God kind of looks at Jesus and he's saying, and God hits a button and you just boop, drop through the floor and nobody knew it happened. That's not what this verse says. This verse says, he will be ashamed of you and you will feel his shame. You will feel the shame of Christ. That's the cost. You know, sometimes people ask, what is the worst part of hell? And again, pop culture gets it wrong. They think it's, well, it's the heat. I mean, it's got to be the heat. That's just brutal. The fire? That'd be terrible. No, anywhere close to the worst part of hell. You know the worst part of hell? It's this right here. It's this right here. Knowing you had a chance to live for Christ, but you chose whatever it is that you're choosing right now instead. Think about that. And you get to live with that for eternity. The recognition of what might have been, but instead you chose earthly pleasures that lasted for such a short time. And now this is the consequence of that. Forever remembering that your last interaction with the one who offered you everything was feeling his shame of you. Don't even talk to me about the worst part of hell. Easily, that right there. That's what I meant earlier. Before you decide what you're going to do, which of those paths you're going to take, before you decide, well, the cost of following Jesus means I got to give up this relationship. It means that I got to give up my big dreams of having a mansion and doing all of this stuff. I got to give up this and I got to give up that. Before you decide that that's too much, I need you to consider what the alternative is and decide which one is the greater cost to your soul. But here's the good news. All right, let me finish with good news. Everybody likes good news. I want you to look back at this verse one more time. If anyone is ashamed of me, that's looking back at the verse, not the people. For heaven's sake, right here. If anyone is ashamed of me and my message, the Son of Man will be ashamed of that person. Do you know who the poster child of that is? If you had to think of the person who was the most ashamed of Jesus that you can possibly think of, who would it be? I'll tell you, you know, because I just read about him just a little bit ago. I'll take you back there. The person who, without question, was the most ashamed of Jesus that a person can possibly be. It's the one who swore a curse on me. I am telling you, I don't know this man that you are talking about. I've never seen him. I don't have anything to do with him. I don't want anything to do with him. Peter is the ultimate poster child for being ashamed of Jesus. But how did his story end? You know how historians flip a few pages to Mark 16. And that's after Jesus' resurrection. And Jesus, after resurrecting, tells the angel who's waiting there at the tomb, hey, this is what you tell them when they come, all right? Be a big surprise. And the women get there, and what does the angel say? Look at this. Don't be alarmed, he said. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go tell his disciples and Peter. I want you to tell Peter. Make sure Peter gets the news that I'm back and I want to see him. I want to be near him. I want to talk to him. I want to forgive him. I want to redeem him. Listen, that's good news for every single one of us. How will your story end? Maybe you have not been living for Christ. You've been living for yourself. You've been filling your life with things that you think will fulfill it, and it isn't going to work. But that's who you've been. Maybe you've been ashamed of life with him. Maybe you don't say it. Maybe we don't say it. But when you walk out the door, everybody says, I don't care what they say about knowing Jesus. I can see it on their Twitter feed, but then I see their real life, and it doesn't match up with the life that is sold out to Christ at all. So maybe without saying it, you've been living a life ashamed and saying to the world, I don't know this man. I don't know the man that I say his name. The good news is, like Peter, you are not doomed to forfeit your soul. No, you're not. Why? Because you're still breathing. And Jesus offers forgiveness. He is offering it to you now. Everything in your life can change, and it can change right now. The Apostle Paul is begging you to echo his words in Romans, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let men say about me what they will. Let them post about me on Facebook what they will. Let them criticize me and ostracize me and put me in a group and label me. It doesn't matter. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Listen. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was right. When Christ calls you, he asks you to come and die. You know why he does it? He does it because he knows that is the only way you can really live. How can you resist his invitation? maybe you need to respond. Maybe for the first time, maybe you need to rededicate. This is the moment. It doesn't matter who's here. All that matters is your life and how it relates to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords that we've heard sung about this morning. Is he the one that you praise? Is he the one that you adore? Or is it yourself? Make that decision. And if it's time, would you come forward as we stand right now and as we sing these words?